Hi, thank you for joining us at U Inc. My name is Rhea Greif, and I'm here with you today, as I am every week, to help build the most important brand in your life, which is you. When we talk about building, we use tools, and the same goes for building our brand. These wellness tools will help elevate your emotional intelligence and help to lead you in a more positive, successful direction in life and in business. Some of these tools you will find helpful today, and some you'll put in a cupboard for another time depending on when you will need to utilize it. This week's tool is point of view, and why it is important to have the ability to see other viewpoints in order to face life's challenges and be able to solve problems effectively and efficiently and creatively. Being able to harness and include other points of view is what I will demonstrate to you that this is a great tool for your brand. So let's start to understand exactly what we mean by point of view. And how I am going to do that is through an exercise that I lead participants through during my seminars to grasp the concept fairly quickly. Let's imagine you're holding a stick in front of you. If you're driving, keep your eye on the road, but in your mind's eye, do this. And if you're at home or at the office, feel free to hold up a pen or a marker. Looking at this stick, if you are a dog, what is this stick to you? Okay, yeah, a toy, right. If you are an angry person, what is this stick to you now? Yep, it's a weapon. What about a musician? What is this stick to a musician? It is an instrument, right? Okay, and now, what is this for us? It's firewood, right? A source of fire, a source of heat. So depending on your point of view, this stick is a toy, a weapon, an instrument, and fire. You're all looking at the same object, a stick, but it means radically different things to each point of view. And guess what? You're all right. You're all correct, even though your interpretations of the stick are different because of your point of view. Now, we understand that people can have point of views, varying ones, looking at the same thing. Why do you want to have this ability to understand other people's point of view? Well, for one, this helps in conflict resolution in business and in your home life. There's an article that says understanding and appreciating the various viewpoints involved in conflict are key factors in resolution. Okay, these articles exist on our website at wcbe.org if you'd like to check them out, as well as all the books that we'll be mentioning today on our program. And of course, this stands to reason. Whenever I am experiencing a disagreement with someone, whether this is at work or life, my boss, my husband, I know I'm right, right? Well, guess what? So does the other person. So what I try to do is ask myself, what makes the other person think that they are right? And if I can figure that out and use those words and let them know that I can see where they're coming from, that I know what their point of view is, then I can approach them with this understanding. And suddenly, the person who once saw themselves as my adversary now aligns themselves with me, and together as allies, we can conquer the problem. Teams that embody members with different point of views are also the most successful because they have individuals who can look at all angles of the same problem and will have greater likelihood to solve it. We all encounter challenges in being able to see other points of view. That's just how our brain works. And to learn about our brain and some of the pitfalls of its functions to gain greater awareness, a good book is The Idiot Brain by Dean Burnett. Also, reading books on how to develop your critical thinking is also useful, and you can find all these books again that we're discussing today, as well as the links and the full podcast of today's episode on our website, wcbe.org, under U Inc. under Programs. I want to go back to our point of view exercise and take it a step further. Let's start with the dog. Interestingly enough, you would think that all dogs see the stick as a toy. And so you imagine that everyone who is like you, in this case, all canines, that the assumption is that they see things the way you do. But what about a dog who's been abused? Now, the toy looks like a punitive tool. What about that angry person? What if that angry person was someone who had been trained in anger management? Now, they don't see a stick as a weapon. They see it as a talking stick in order to take turns talking through the problem. Even in the case of the musician, one musician might see a drumstick, another might see a conductor's baton, and the list goes on and on. So it's important that we develop this empathy, being able to see another point of view, because not only are these the characteristics of a highly emotionally intelligent person, but in an article published by The Atlantic this week, it also allows you to have empathy for your future self. And what does that mean? This means by being able to put yourself in your own shoes, your future shoes, you have an ability to gain control of your impulses and be able to show restraint. Whether this is for a New Year's resolution, quitting smoking, deciding not to have another drink or another bowl of guacamole. Not a bad incentive to being able to have the tool point of view. Okay, think you got it down? Quick quiz. Imagine you're at an office party. There's cake and donuts. What do you see? A treat? A celebration? What might some others see? For example, a person who has celiac disease is looking at this as poison. A person who's an emotional eater might see this as a drug they're about to get high on. So please keep these things in mind as you proceed. It is very rare or almost impossible that an event can be negative from all points of view. And that is a quote from the Dalai Lama. Walk the mile in my shoes. You abuse, criticize and accuse, walk the mile in my shoes. Dr. Pam Popper has a bachelor's, master's, and PhD in nutrition, as well as a degree in naturopathy. She's had a role in documentaries urging people to see another way for themselves in terms of choices. Making a Killing, the Untold Story of Psychotropic Drugging, Processed People, Forks Over Knives, and she's also had a New York Times bestseller for 66 weeks as a companion book for Forks Over Knives as well. Her most recent book, Food Over Medicine, The Conversation That Can Save Your Life, which was also written with Glenn Mercer, includes also recipes from Chef Del Shroff, is a book that helps us understand what her mission is, which is to educate people to be informed medical consumers. And that is also her practice specialty, to help people make informed medical choices. She's an avid reader and has an enormous library, and she says that she spends more on books than most people spend on clothes. And she is the kind of person who wants to have it all. She has a great career, friends, travel, she's into fitness, fun, and she likes to experience as many things as she can every day. And one of the reasons that she attributes her success is the fact that she doesn't need a lot of sleep. And that's what I want to know about Dr. Popper. How can I get by on less sleep?
Well, you might not be able to get by on less sleep. It's an interesting thing. I've always been a person who didn't sleep long, okay, 4 or 5 hours up. When I was a kid, this was the case. And my parents finally made a rule that you just have to stay in your room. Mm-hmm. You can't come out and wander around. And so all through my adult life, people have said, one of these days you're going to get sick. If I ever got a cold, it's because you don't sleep at night and this sort of thing. I read an interesting book. You mentioned I'm into books, and I'm always walking around used bookstores looking for treasures that you don't see in the new bookstore. Mm-hmm. Found a book earlier this year called No More Sleepless Nights, and it was written by the medical doctor who set up the Mayo Clinic sleep program before they drugged everybody. Had some very interesting things to say in this book, and one of them is there are short sleepers, medium sleepers, and long sleepers. And this has nothing to do with your intellect or anything else. There are great people in history. You know, I think it was Thomas Edison who was a short sleeper, and Einstein was a long sleeper. So it had nothing to do with that. It's just the way that you're made.
One of the articles that I read recently was that it's a genetic mutation for some people. It came out this week and says that some people have a gene that allows, like you said, allows them to get by in a lot less sleep. So do you think that it's about this gene, and can we develop this gene? I know a lot of people would like to do that.
Oh, I think we've tried to develop this gene for a long time. Part of this is just difference in people. And then there's even variation day to day. I mean, when I really wear myself out, I remember one day a couple of years ago, I took a yoga class, taught a yoga class. You know, we have a hot yoga studio in my building. So it's 105 degrees in there and 40% humidity. And then I was just all fired up. So I cleaned the carpets and then I decided to wash the walls. And, you know, I had been in that hot room for like 9 hours. Oh my gosh, that was not a 5 hour sleeping night. That was longer. So I think there's a tendency in medicine, and I've been writing a lot about this lately, to try to standardize everybody. There are some things we can say universally. When we talk about diet, for example, mm-hmm. there are some universal truths. Mm-hmm. But humans aren't all the same, mm-hmm. and they aren't even the same day to day sometimes. Mm-hmm. And we just need to allow for that variation. And there may be a genetic variant that accounts for this. I'm not really sure about that. I don't think we really entirely understand the role of genes and what happens to us. We do in certain cases. I mean, I have brown eyes because of my genes, but whether or not genetic tendencies cause me to sleep differently, I don't really know that we know the answer to that question at this point.
Your company, Wellness Forum Health, you're the executive director, and you've built this company up for 20 years now. So you began this endeavor because you wanted to counter what the pharmaceutical companies and many healthcare providers are recommending, and that you are sick, this is the malaise model, here's the drug on this page of the manual that you need to do. How did you take those first steps towards communicating a new point of view, towards getting people to see that there's another approach to healthcare? How did you get started with that whole process?
Well, I came upon this by accident. I was 20 years into my adult life, and I had a career in business and sales training, and I was successful at that. I don't really think I ever loved it. Mm-hmm. I was just good at it because I like to be good at things. If you do something, you should do it right, kind of thing. That's, you know, work ethic, European family work ethic, yeah. Right? But not really thinking this is my passion. So this became my passion, and it was an accidental discovery. I just read an article in a magazine that piqued my interest, and one thing led to another. But and my first interest, by the way, was really in the nutrition field. And then I quickly realized that not only do we have the wrong idea about diet, we have the wrong idea about healthcare in general. So I broadened my horizons quite a bit. It's an interesting question you ask. How do you present this? How do you get people to understand what it is? How do you get people to understand that they need to pay attention to it? What I found really works best is to show people how ineffective some of the choices that they have made or are getting ready to make are. So let me give you an example. When people come to dinners, we do them once a month in our office, we present a lot of information on common medical choices. We show what an informed decision process looks like. And I use coronary artery disease because 44% of the people in our country die from heart disease, so you get a little more commonality there. Everybody knows somebody mm-hmm. who's had a heart attack, a stroke, right. Whatever. And so I say, okay, let's take a look at the traditional treatment here. All right, so statin drugs commonly prescribed to treat high cholesterol. Now, this blows people away, but Crestor, one of the most popular ones, lowers your risk of a heart attack, stroke, or death by 1.2%. Lipitor is the best of the bunch, 1.6%. If you average them all out, 0.7% reduction in risk. Now, people are flabbergasted at that. These are expensive drugs. They have 23 pages of side effects. I think most people think that they're protected yeah. when they take them. And then if you take aspirin for primary prevention, you get as many bleed outs as you get strokes prevented. So you kill one, you save one. I mean, these are horrific ratios. Right. Nobody in their right mind would consent to this upfront with that knowledge. And it's the reason why informed decision-making isn't practiced in a medical institution. It's bad for business. It's hard to keep the doors open when people are saying, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that, I don't want to do any of it, I'm not coming back. Now, having said that, I want to make something really clear, because I've been accused of being anti-pharmaceutical. Not. I think that there's a time and a place for everything. Our problem, there's no money to be made, real money, not like the drug companies and the medical institutions make now. If you use drugs and procedures for only the people who benefit from them, the market and the money gets made when everybody becomes a consumer. So instead of giving statin drugs to people who have familial hypercholesterolemia, we give them to everybody who has high cholesterol, even those people who could easily eat their way out of it. Instead of using aspirin only for targeted situations, people who have serious AFib, now let's put everybody over the age of 50 on a daily aspirin regimen. That's how you make money with aspirin. We do 500,000 bypass surgeries every year in the United States. About, 485,000 of them are warranted, or not warranted, rather, 15,000 are. But you can't make big institutions profitable if you're only going to do 15,000 bypass surgeries right. in the country. So we try to make these things applicable to everybody. Now, the point that I am making about all of this mm-hmm. is that once you go through this, now you can show people a different alternative. Let me show you what the results look like if you change your diet. Let's look at this from a different point of view, picking up on what you said.
Right.
Let's not look at high cholesterol as a Crestor deficiency. Let's look at it as a dietary deficiency or excess, as the case may be. Here's a different way to solve it. Then you throw the decision back to the consumer, because the consumer should decide, based on the information, getting away from this maternalistic, paternalistic view of healthcare where somebody says, do this. We call that informing, by the way, in the healthcare field. And the patient says, okay, and we call that consenting.
I recently read a book. It's called I Contain Multitudes by Ed Young. And it talks about how microbes have a direct effect on our mood and our choices. In wanting to get people to embrace new eating choices, for example, you know, if they have terrible gut health, so this leads them to not be able to have those good choices. Now we have this catch-22. What is one way that people can kind of break out of that?
Well, the first thing is that you can certainly make good choices even if you have a messed up gut, and people do it all the time. The problem is not that your gut is driving the choices. The problem is that in the absence of fixing the gut, the new and improved eating habits will not have the same effect. Mm. And so one of the things I write a lot about and talk a lot about is reductionism. Everybody wants to find the most small part of something and attribute magical powers to it. So let me give you some examples that will help you understand. So kiwi fruits are good sources of vitamin C. Well, I don't want to eat fruit, so I'll just take vitamin C pills. And that's a reductionist attitude toward nutrition, because kiwi fruit also contains 100,000 other nutrients that all work in synergy. You're better off eating that food than one nutrient from that food. Another example of reductionism, going back to our discussion about coronary artery disease. You have high cholesterol. That's not a good thing. But we take a statin drug. The reason they're not very effective is they just lower your cholesterol. You're not dealing with the totality of how this happened, which is the way you eat and take care of yourself. Okay, so that's reductionism. Looking at the gut microbiome. If you just take probiotics, it's not going to fix anything. If you continue to take steroid drugs, birth control pills, antibiotics from time to time, and eat garbage. On the other hand, if the only thing you do is change your diet and you don't address the needless testing, drugs you shouldn't take, and take probiotics, for example, if you have a messed up gut, you're not going to get better. So that's another area where we help people from the standpoint of informed decision making is understanding that in order to get better, in order to live life fully, you have to look at the totality of what's going on in your life. I mean, I see people who eat a perfect diet and they're still unhealthy. They've never looked at all the rest of the issues affecting their health. And then they don't exercise. I mean, all kinds of other things that come into this. I mean, this whole idea of how we live, it's bigger than any one of these things that we're talking about.
Are you still a practicing vegan?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't teach that in my company, but yes, I am for my own choices. Yeah.
It's interesting. Also, another thing that I had read about is that, you know, now people are saying fat's in vogue. Fat is good for you. And you're still kind of on that low fat kind of point of view.
Well, I don't think that's a point of view. That's called science.
Okay.
And this is where we leave the point of view discussion and we talk about what science says. And that's in fact informed decision making. Mm-hmm. The data is the data is the data is the data. Now, having said that, one of the things we have to do with people to put them through this process is we have to teach them how to read medical literature. Again, it's back to this thing. People say, well, I can't do that. I can teach anybody how to do it in an afternoon. We do it every day at our office. Okay. So the key is now you have to understand the difference between good studies and bad studies.
Right. Like fake news.
It's worse than that because it's stuff that looks legitimate, but it's not. So let me give you an example of how you could structure a study that shows that it doesn't matter that you eat fat. And this is done all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you take a group of people and they're eating a diet that's 40% fat. And then you reduce the fat to 38% in another group of people. And you show that you're not worse off for eating more fat. Well, nobody was eating a low-fat diet. Okay, so let me give you a comparison. I teach by analogy. Let's say that we're going to look at the effect of driving a car into a building going 90 miles an hour. So we put crash dummies in the car and we drive it into the building. The evidence is all the crash dummies are dead. If there were four people in the car, they'd be dead. Now we repeat the experiment. We do it at 80 miles an hour and the crash dummies are still dead. And what we report is it doesn't matter how fast you're driving the car when you hit the building. Speed doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's ludicrous. We structured a study to show that speed doesn't matter because we have an interest in having you drive your car fast.
Right.
Well, that happens all the time. So fat is back in vogue, not because it's a good idea. I mean, the Japanese, the Okinawans eat a diet that's 9% of calories from fat. They're some of the longest lived people
in the blue zones, yeah. Right.
So there are no people living those lifespans eating a high fat diet. But the studies are structured so that you can show that. They're not structured well. And the other problem you have is this new thing with reporters at the New York Times and other places writing books on health who have great intentions, I'm sure. I always attribute good intentions to everybody.
Sure.
They do not understand how to read the science. If they spent an afternoon in my office and one of my staff showed them how to do it, they would withdraw their books from the market and they would take up some other occupation. I'm confident of it because they would see the fallacy in their thinking. I've had college interns who, and sometimes we get these books that people write and we take them apart so that we can use them as examples of bad research. I've had college interns who can take a book written by a medical doctor that promotes some of this nonsense and show the fallacy of the thinking. The problem is that, first of all, when we take apart some of these books, you find out, first of all, there's a lot of hypothesizing going on. And I just want to, on the paleo diet, at the time that it's claimed that we ate that diet, we were about 60-pound, barely bipedal creatures living mostly in the trees without any weaponry. And the thought that we actually ran and overcame animals.
Right.
I mean, the fastest person in the world runs just under 4 miles an hour. And there, most animals in Africa would outrun you easily.
Right.
Okay. Another thing I'll point out, this is a discussion we could have for hours and hours.
Sure.
But we have a few hunter-gatherer tribes left.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a single one of them living on the hunting.
Right.
Okay. They're all living on the gathering because they can't hunt enough. They can't kill enough. And now they actually do have some sophisticated weaponry, not in the terms of weapons and that sort of thing, but I mean, bows and arrows and things like that that are more sophisticated. And the Maasai do not live off of what they hunt.
Right.
You know, so the bottom line is that if you really start to look at science, and again, we get away from point of view. Now we're going to look at science.
Right.
You find that these books and these people are giving a point of view.
Right.
They are not adhering to the science.
Right.
And they cherry pick studies. They misrepresent what the studies say. It's unfortunate. It misleads a lot of people.
Do you eat anything that's bad for you?
Yeah, but bad for me in a different way. The first thing, I think it's very important when people make changes of any type, it has to be sustainable. Okay, long-term compliance is the thing that's missing in almost every program out there. I don't even like to call them programs, but that means that you can't have perfection as the goal. Because I don't know about you, I think the thought of being perfect at anything is just exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me not even want to get up and try,
right?
And the other problem with perfection is that if you set that as what's supposed to happen, then when people fail, they just quit. It's like I tried to be perfect and I couldn't. So the first thing we do is we take perfection out. One thing that we do that helps people is instead of saying you can't ever have another cookie and all that sort of thing, let's differentiate between food and treats. The reason my office is full every day is because people have lost that distinction. They're treating themselves 13 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to have some cookies, you know, holiday parties are a good time to do that. Cake is good for a birthday. You know, champagne's nice on New Year's Eve, but those are treats and they've become part of the daily fare. People live. I see children who are living on what I call the birthday party diet.
Mm-hmm.
They have sugary cereal for breakfast,
yep.
And then they have cheeseburgers and french fries for lunch. They have brownies after school and they have some pizza for dinner and potato chips while they watch TV. That's the birthday party diet.
Right.
So no, I'm not perfect. I don't eat any animal foods because I just choose not to do that. And my diet is really, I mean, on regular days, like a day like today, it's just a regular day. I'm going to eat really great food all day long. But I do have a cocktail once in a while.
Okay.
And my guilty pleasure is coffee. But coffee, I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that it's bad for most people.
Mm-hmm.
And I do like dessert from time to time. My company just celebrated its 20th anniversary.
Congratulations.
There was cake. I had some. And I had a cocktail because that's a big deal.
Right.
But, you know, you get up the next day. And you're back to smoothies and broccoli and rice and vegetables and stir fries and sweet potatoes and the stuff you're supposed to eat.
Great. You've developed obviously a very strong passion for your line of work. You serve on the Physician Steering Committee and the President's Board for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, in addition to just running your business. So one of the dangers that sometimes people run into as a scientist, we know that we want to be evidence-based. How do you try to keep some maybe different points of view around so that we don't become too also, you know, exclusive from other ideas?
I think that when you're in the health business, You have one point of view. It's called follow the evidence, and you can't cherry pick the studies. You can't use the people have the tyranny of the latest study. I read a study that showed blah blah blah. Well, let me tell you how important this is. I can put together a 45-minute workshop for you on why smoking is actually not so bad and it could be beneficial,
mm-hmm.
using references from the New England Journal of Medicine, the Lancet, British Med, the Big Five. Okay. And you would start to think, well, probably not you because you know better, but somebody could listen to this and go, wow, maybe I should even try it.
Right. Okay?
But in order to do that, I've got to cherry pick. I've got to violate all the rules of evidence and cherry pick, ignore the preponderance of the evidence, misrepresent, in fact, a little bit of what these studies say, pick one point from the summary instead of all of them. But I could make that case. So I don't think you can afford to have a point of view on things like smoking. Should you take an ACE inhibitor or not? Should you have a bypass surgery or not? The evidence has to be clearly presented, mm-hmm. and then you have to decide what you want to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a pretty black and white display of information. Now, let me tell you where we get into the gray area. The gray area is when you have something like terminal cancer. And a colleague of mine, in fact, she did a presentation for one of our conferences, wrote a book about this, Radical Remission, recommended to everybody who has cancer. Her name is Dr. Kelly Turner. She did the first study ever that looked at terminal cancer patients who survived and outlived their prognosis by years or sometimes decades.
Mm-hmm.
And she found out, she interviewed them, none of them knew each other. She found out that terminal cancer patients use a total of about 75 strategies to survive. But the interesting thing was all 1,000 of them were using the same 9. Now, this is very telling,
mm-hmm.
okay? Now, one of them was they ate well, first chapter. They ate a diet much like the one that we recommend at my office. They also followed their intuition, and they did a lot of out-of-the-box treatment, okay? Now, this is when I think it's okay to have a point of view. What do you feel strongly about? We don't have any treatments for stage 4 pancreatic cancer patients, and why we talk them out of doing anything is beyond my comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is if you have type 2 diabetes and you're taking metformin, it takes about 3 weeks for most people to get you off of that drug and begin the process of turning you into a former diabetic. It's inexcusable.
Mm-hmm.
To be saying, well, you know, you could do this over here and you could breathe deep and you could, I mean, people come up with some pretty silly suggestions for conditions where the evidence is overwhelming
mm-hmm.
what we should do. So I think the key is there's a place to go to that fuzzy place that you're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have to be very careful about how we use that and make sure. The other thing I'll say, too, is sometimes it's okay to say, we don't have any evidence for this. Let me give you an example. There is no evidence to suggest that acupuncture, evidence, published medical journal articles,
mm-hmm.
that acupuncture helps patients with myasthenia gravis. A lot of case reports, people saying, I did this, it helped me. It's not toxic, you're not going to hurt yourself
right.
with it. A myasthenia gravis patient, you could say, look, I can't show you a study that says this is a good idea. You're not going to get hurt by it. If you want to try it, it might work for you. So being honest about it, instead of going about this with all moral authority and arrogance, this is the thing you should do. So many times it's the way that something is presented
yes.
when it's presented to somebody that can make the difference
yes.
too.
All right, guys, well, check out the truth with Dr. Pam Popper. Thank you for coming out today.
Thank you.
And now, a word from our person on the street. So tell us, wise one, what are your thoughts on point of view?
Point of view, for me, is a tool that I use to kind of get a feeling for what the person I'm dealing with might be going through. So like considering my point of view isn't necessarily their point of view. So I try to consider, you know, where are they coming from? What, you know, context are they working from? What are they thinking about? What are their concerns?
And how do you do that?
I just open myself to the conversation. So we'll have a conversation. I'll ask them questions about, you know, what are their concerns? You know, basically to get an understanding of what their concerns might be, you have to, you know, ask those questions.
And have you been successful?
Mostly.
Okay, thank you. And that's our show for today, folks. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Maria Greif, and you've been listening to You Inc. on 90.5 WCBE.